can start with a few questions we're asking about premillennial, amillennial, postmillennial. Maybe you could give us just a quick definition of those different positions and maybe a little bit of a historical background about why those positions have become popular throughout modern church history.
Going to grab their mic and be double mic'd. But the early church was totally premillennial for roughly the first 200 years, and because the text said that. In fact, Eusebius in the 330s wrote a book called Ecclesiastical History, and he was the theologian for Constantine after the church was Christianized. He was the tutor for Constantine's son, and his grandson turned out to be Julian the Apostate, so I don't know how good of a disciple he was. But he wrote the first major history of the church, and in it he talks about Papias, who is probably as early of a church father as we have. And tradition says that Papias was discipled by the Apostle John, and there's one tradition that's questioned that he was also discipled by the Apostle Paul. And Eusebius says he's the father of Chiliasm. Chiliasm meaning what we call premillennialism today. So here's a guy who was discipled by possibly the Apostle Paul and clearly discipled by the Apostle John, who is considered the father of premillennialism. And Eusebius goes on and says, however, Papias was a man of wee little intellect. See, by the 300s, and Eusebius hated premillennialism. And so what he said is what we've heard for hundreds, a couple thousand years, is that if you believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible, you've got two brains. One's lost and the other's out looking for it. You know, I mean, you got to be deaf, dumb, and blind to do that, you see. And so it was when the great intellectuals of Alexandria, Egypt came along, and the rest of the church was premillennial. And there was a single source from where anti-millennialism came from, Alexandria, where Greek philosophy was dominant, you see. Because you had had, before Christianity, you had Philo from Alexandria, a Jewish guy who started allegorizing the Old Testament. And then you had Clement of Alexandria, who in around 180 started allegorizing the Bible. And he had a disciple named Origen in the early 200s who really was a champion. Origen was barely considered what they call an orthodox father. He was on the edge there, you see, because of his. And they believe in multi-layered interpretations, the body, soul, and spirit, basically, and that the literal interpretation represented the body, which was bad because of Greek Platonic philosophy. Nothing physical could be good. And then you had the soulish, which was the intellectual, second. And then the spiritual, that's the highest. And that's why Eusebius makes fun of Papias, who is considered the father of premillennialism in the early church. And, of course, John, the apostle, you'd think he would know, right? And the guy's discipled directly by him. And you also have, what was his name? One of the seven churches, the martyr, Polycarp, thank you, who was pastor of one of the seven churches in Asia, Smyrna, yes. And he was discipled by the Apostle John as well, because, you know, John went after the destruction of Jerusalem. He clearly went to Asia and lived in Ephesus. Strong church tradition says that. So he had a 35-year influence there, and then he was exiled on the island of Patmos there, and he saw the So you have premillennialism so dominant in the early church that most scholars say it was part of orthodoxy. It was almost like a doctrine of orthodoxy. It was so widely held. And then they eat away at it, and Augustine comes in. So you have Jerome in the late 300s, who is the church's first scholar. He translates the Bible into Greek and from Greek and Hebrew into Latin. And his translation came out in the late 90s, and he was the first real commentator. There were others that preceded him. And he wrote commentaries on a lot of the Bible. And in the book of Daniel, his commentary on Daniel, and the way they did commentaries back then, they didn't write a commentary and another guy to write a separate commentary. They'd take a guy who'd written a commentary and they would add to it. So it's hard to know who said what, when, and where. You see, they would just keep adding to these commentaries and passing them down. And so you have Jerome making a statement in his commentary on Daniel saying, away with the 1,000 years. And so he's the scholar of the church. And then Augustine becomes the great theologian of the church in the early 400s. And he says he moved from premillennialism to amillennialism. So think of this as, here's the early church founded in around 33, 34 AD. And you're 350 years later. That's a while, really, when you think about it. And so this stuff had come in over 200 to 300 years and pushed premillennialism out. And as late as the 400s, you still had very strong pockets in the early church of premillennialism. So, and I've noticed this in individuals. They first become anti-premillennial, and then they gravitate toward amill or postmill. You see what I'm saying? You have to go, but they object for some reason to the literal interpretation to premillennialism in their individual. I've seen that in friends of mine over the years, and that's what happened historically. And so they look, basically it's people who don't want to accept what the text actually says, and you have all of this Old Testament stuff that is added to and everything, and so the church faded away. And then by the 500s, it was a sub-statement in one of the creeds, and basically the Roman Catholic Church banned, and the Greek Orthodox as well, for over 1,000 years, banned premillennialism. You'd be declared a heretic if you wrote anything about premillennialism. And so it was revived in the post-Reformation era by people like the Puritans. Actually, there are two key events that led to the, in the late 1500s, that led to the revival of premillennialism. There was a note in the Geneva Bible, the 1559 first edition, and this was by Theodore Beza, who did Romans, in which he said that Romans 11 was teaching a future for Israel as a nation. Just one sentence. And then there was the discovery of the lost five chapters of Irenaeus's Against Heresy. And Irenaeus is considered the most orthodox of the anti-Nicene, in other words, before the Council of Nicaea, 325, church father. And he was the most developed, staunchest premillennialist. And they had suppressed, in the Middle Ages, his last five chapters that deal with eschatology. He even has a section in there on why prophecy should be interpreted literally. And he believed, he was just as anti-Semitic, by the way, as all the rest of the early church and later people were. But that's a whole other story. But he was very strongly premillennial. And so they rediscovered in 1573, I think it was, the lost five chapters. And that encouraged Puritans to, or post-Reformation people, to start reading the church fathers who were strongly premillennial. And that led to a revival of premillennialism. By the 1600s, almost all English and American Puritans were premillennial. Cromwell was premillennial. Who's the guy that wrote the poetry? Milton was premillennial. The founding fathers in America were premillennial. a lot of people say, well, I thought they were postmillennial. No, postmillennialism came in the 1700s with Jonathan, with the Enlightenment. You see, they were millennialists, and then the postmillennialism came 100 years later when the Enlightenment had a big impact. But the Puritan founding fathers were pro-Israel. And this is why America has had so many Jewish people, because we did not bring from Europe our medieval Catholic Jew hatred to America. And you had Increase Mather, whose father, Richard Mather, was a Cambridge graduate, and Increase was the second president of Harvard. Did I say that right? Thank you. And that's why Harvard is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because, see, certain Puritans immigrated to the United States, and they were mainly Cambridge graduates, not Oxford graduates at that time. And so you have them coming, and Richard Mather makes a statement that all of the Puritans in America were premillennial. He makes that statement. And his son, Increase Mather, is the second president of Harvard, wrote his first book, and he revised it 8 times. And he only had published 125 books in his life. He was a slacker compared to his son. And he married John Cotton's daughter and named their son Cotton Mather. And he only had 425 books, many multi-volumes, published in his life. No video games, no looking at the phone and all of that kind of stuff, and a little more serious culture, you see. And so they were big-time premillennialists. All the Mather clan were big-time premillennialists. And Increase Mather's favorite book was about the return of the Jews, how the Jews are going to return to the land of Israel. So that starts in the early 1600s. In fact, in 1573, there was a Cambridge graduate named Francis Kett who was burned at the stake 1573 for writing in a book that Israel returned to the land. And it was the British who first expelled the Jews in 1290 from England. And they developed the myth about blood libel, you know, that the Jews had to have the blood of a Gentile during Passover. That was called the blood libel. Came out of England at that time as well. And John Owen, the great John Owen, he was post-millennial, but he preached a sermon in the 1650s on behalf of Oliver Cromwell. He was Cromwell's theologian, about how the Bible taught that the Jews were going to be scattered to every nation on the earth. And England had no Jews in it. Therefore, England was preventing the second coming. And they needed to have Jews come back into England. And so he won the day. And Parliament passed a bill and paid for a boatload of Jews to be brought from Amsterdam. And they began repopulating England so Christ could return again. Now, I don't agree with that theology, but nevertheless, that won the day, and it shows you how the Puritans were very different. And where does the term Judeo-Christianity come from? It comes from the Puritans. It doesn't come from Roman Catholicism or Greek Orthodoxy, I'll tell you that. They hated the Jews. And so it comes from America, Harvard, the first American university, just beat out William and Mary by a few months. And I think Mary wasn't quite ready yet. So she delayed them. And but you had Harvard, its first 5 years did not even teach Greek, it taught Hebrew. And up until the 1870s, after the Civil War, if you were the valedictorian at Harvard, you had to deliver your valedictorian message in Hebrew. So this shows you the early influence of them discovering in the early 1500s literacy and study of the original languages, which had for 1,500 years been wiped out. So they're reading the Bible, if they knew English, in English and in Greek and Hebrew in the original language, and they're seeing Israel all over the place, you see, unfiltered by the Roman Catholic magisterium, you see. And so they're saying, hey, the Bible talks about Israel. The Bible talks about Israel, see. And so Ket, when he was burned at the stake, said that he claimed, they said in the history book, that he had learned this from the Bible. Imagine that. So, premillennialism is the belief that Christ is going to return before the millennium, and it also involves a belief in two literal resurrections. Those are the two main issues, because Tychonius, who influenced Augustine, said that the first resurrection was regeneration when you become a believer in Revelation 20, and the second was an actual resurrection. Even though the word anastasis, resurrection, never refers to a spiritual use, it always refers to the physical resurrection of the body. So that's the allegorical view. They had to get around that. And so amillennialism came in the early 400s with the city of God, the positive statement of amillennialism that we're living in the city of God, the Roman Catholic Church, you see. And before that, you had, as I said, back to the 200s, anti-millennialism, where people just did not believe in a literal millennium. They didn't have anything positive in its place. So that's anti-millennialism, and then it developed an amillennialism. And so amillennialism believes that the church is currently reigning. It's the millennium now. And there's two versions. Either the millennium's in heaven, or the millennium is on earth through the Catholic Church. And then Hokema invented a newer form, where there's some amills today are saying that the millennium is the eternal state. But there's still no earthly reign, literally, of Christ on the earth. Anthony Hokema, a reformed guy out of Michigan. And then you have postmillennialism, which is a form of amillennialism with optimism thrown in, that the world is going to be converted. I explained that during my talk. And they take the same basic interpretive views of the first resurrection is regeneration, salvation, and the second resurrection is the physical, you know, thing. But that God is going to convert most postmillennialists, say a majority, but not necessarily all, and the church is going to take over the political, social institutions, or not take over. They would be offended by that. They would say is going to influence. Yes, and so they're going to. If you characterize saying they're going to bring the kingdom in, they would say no. Christ brought the kingdom in his first coming. We're advancing the kingdom. So Christ brought the. And both amill and postmill would say the kingdom was inaugurated or brought in by Christ at his first coming, and we're in it, a spiritual form of the kingdom now.
Just doesn't come from a vacuum. It doesn't come from a good idea. It comes from a fundamental commitment to certain passages that he believes teaches certain things, or history of these things being taught. What about, let's name a couple others. John Piper is actually a historical premier.
Right.
John, so.
But he seems to function more like an army.
He does, a little bit, yeah.
He doesn't like Israel either.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing. That's another litmus test, I think. It's what is this author or this leader's position on Israel? Like, well, we're not talking about certain policies that Israeli government is making or anything like that. this policy, and they're critical of it. We're not talking about that. We're talking about what is their view, overall view, of God's plan and purpose for the nation of Israel. Not that their majority of them are unbelievers right now, but God's plan and purpose and his heart and his love for his people and their future for Israel. If you're premillennial, you're definitely going to have a very positive, optimistic, as well as a very congenial, because you know we believe that the church has come into the rich root of Abrahamic covenant, and we've been grafted in, and so we're very pro-Israel, and we look at Israel as our older brother, if you will, right? That's a very different view, emotional response, and shall I say even support for the present state of Israel than an alternate view. Do you know of any like famous evangelical leaders who hold to, you mentioned Piper, that he doesn't hold to a very positive view on Israel, even though he's a historic premill. Historic premill is not dispensational premill, it's a difference. But do you know of any other evangelical leaders that kind of are openly that way? You talked about Hank Hanegraaff,
right?
Bible Lens. How many of you guys know of Hank Hanegraaff? Okay, you see how evangelical they are.
Yeah.
Liberal Berkeleyans here. Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, National Syndicated
Radio. How many
of
y'all listen to the radio? See, about the same amount. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Hardly anybody listens to the radio anymore.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he was at this Bethlehem Bible Conference. Like, Lynn Hybels is very anti-Israel. She's one they
Phil Hybels'
wife? Yes.
Yeah, Lynn Hybels.
Andy Stanley. Dallas Seminary graduate, classmate of mine, is very has become anti-Israel. Charisma Magazine's son is very anti-Israel, and they've got some magazine for young people that, you know, and so the millennials are becoming very strongly anti-Israel because they think mom and dad, you know, they read Lego Planet Earth, Hal Lindsey, and they talked about their whole life about how he's so mom and dad weren't involved socially and politically, you know, and we should be involved in helping the poor and doing all of this. So they blame dispensationalism and a focus on Bible prophecy, sitting around waiting for the rapture, you know. Well, at least some of us are writing books and things in the process. But nevertheless, so the millennials have shifted, I think, from Bible study, generally speaking, to social action. And I think they picked that up from the emphasis in the world, in my humble opinion there.
Right. Thank you. That's clarifying. So, recap, pre-mill, before the millennium, literal millennial kingdom. Post-mill, Jesus is going to come after the millennial kingdom. And the millennial kingdom, therefore, it cannot be literal, it has to be figurative. No mill. That means no millennial kingdom. Again, a figurative interpretation. So as Dr. Ice has outlined, the six kilia, 1,000 years, 1,000 years, 1,000 years, six times, just in that chapter 20 of Revelation, they take all of that, the post and awe, as non-literal. Therefore, they have to inject some sort of a pre-canned theological system for their interpretation, whereas the literal reading of that would be a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ, which fits like hand to a glove from all the Old Testament prophecies and what prophets said. A glorious time for Israel, a time of great blessing, prosperity, and peace and justice where the Messiah will reign. That's a premillennial. So a premillennial view is the right view. That's different from pre, mid, and post-tribulation. Right, so don't get those tribulational views mixed up. This is when will Christ return?
And in relation to the kingdom, premillennials are the only ones that believe in a future literal kingdom. And some premills believe in a present spiritual form that's called already, not yet. So that makes things even more complicated.
That's what was taught where I was in seminary. My professor wrote a book called Progressive Dispensationalism.
He's the father of progressive dispensationalism.
Dr. Robert Soucy, right?
And so obviously that does have influence on us, but studying the scriptures is always the best way to go for it.
But you know, he has some of the best defenses for Israel and premillennialism that are out there. But that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, he does, yeah. All right. Good word, good word. You want to go to the second question?
All right, we've got a bunch of other questions here. Maybe you could help us sort out. You've talked a lot about a future events, resurrections, a bema seat judgment. Could you just go over in brief? What's going to happen? What are the major future events that are going to happen for Christians and for the Jew and the Gentile who live through some of these other things happening?
You wrote the book on chronology, so I'll correct you if you're wrong.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we it hasn't made the press yet, so you can correct me quickly. But the events is we're living toward the end of the church age, most likely. And the next prophetic event is the rapture. Now, the fact that Israel's back in the land, it did not have to happen at this point in history, but it did. In other words, when we say we believe in an imminent rapture, we mean that Christ could come at any moment. There's no signs or anything that have to be fulfilled. It's been that way for 2,000 years. But God can do things like he's brought Israel. He's bringing, it's in the process. That's why I don't think it's finally fulfilled. It's in the process of being fulfilled. And he created Israel as a nation again. And I ask people, you know, if God, Acts 17, determines the time and the boundaries of the nations, you know, and the Bible doesn't teach a future for Israel, then why did God allow that? What's wrong with God? Point is God did allow that. In fact, if you read the details of the history, you had to have like 500 out of 500 things go right for Israel to have become a nation today, and all 500 things went right. You know, I call that Calvinist luck. You know, I mean, the providence of God. If you start reading the details of how Israel, I mean, it's just amazing. But nevertheless, and so the tribulation is going to happen. What you do is you build a profile of what the events of tribulation are going to look like. You know, the people, the places, the things, and all of that. And we see, I had a debate at Oxford University here in 2007, and I gave three reasons, because they had the debate topic as the end is nigh, a little British lingo there. And this house believes the end is nigh, so they had to bring an American which was me. And I gave three basic reasons. I didn't want to get too complicated at a school like Oxford, you know, because these people are so ignorant of biblical things. But nevertheless, I said, number one, Israel's back in the land. That's the super sign of the end times. You can't argue with that. They're back in the land. You might, and I've talked to a bunch of unbelievers, and they, oh, it's conspiracy theory or something. That runs the world in it or something, you know. And, okay, secondly is the revived Roman Empire is being foreshadowed by the European Union. And most people in the European Union hate the European Union, you know. And then thirdly, globalism. Everybody at any intellectual level will tell you we have to move toward globalism. And they say that, you know, we went through the individual, the family, the tribe, the gather and getter, or whatever they call, you know, the different phases of civilization. And finally, in the 1800s, you may not know this, but that was when Germany became Germany. There were 181 German states that Bismarck in the late 1800s, you know, made into one nation, Germany. So you had the rise of nationalism in the 1800s. And then that, they say, produced the 20th century, which is nothing but wars. It's nations fighting nations. So we have to move to a global government where we have a central power that can. I guarantee you, over at Berkeley, everybody is a globalist economically. All of these other things. You know, so I gave those three reasons, and so I didn't hardly get any blowback because I don't think they knew enough to ask or talk or discuss it. But so you have that happening. You have the fact that Russia is predicted to invade Israel, probably after the rapture, but before the tribulation. I'm not dogmatic about that. And so you see Russia and Iran and all of these different nations, and now for the first time in history, the last few years, Russia and Iran are hanging out together doing military stuff. Turkey will be involved in that. And so they're going to attack Israel, and God's going to supernaturally save them. So you have the Russia-Magog war and all of that that is being set up, probably. And then you have the events of the tribulation, the Antichrist. So you have the revived Roman Empire, and it takes time. It says the little horn comes up among the ten horns. So you have to have the ten-nation confederacy, and then the little horn comes up. And then he makes the covenant with Israel. It starts the tribulation, you see. And so you have with rise of nationalism in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you have the reformation of Israel's ancient enemies, you know, like Egypt became. So they're all part of the Turkish Empire, the single Islamic kingdom that was broken up when the Ottoman Empire was defeated in World War I. And so you have Syria and Iraq, there was Persia and all these different countries that have reformulated that are going to be involved in the last days as well. And so you have this idea of centralization, or a global government that, even though Dante in the 1300s was the first ideologically to come up with it, it's only been being implemented in our own day, you know, and we're clearly moving toward that. And it was brought up, this was a month after Obama had got elected, and they asked me about what I thought about Obama, and I said, well, I said, the reason y'all hated George W. Bush so much is because he acted in the interest of the United States as a nation, nationalism. And everybody in Europe just hated his guts. I'd be over there in England, and where are you from? Texas. Texas Bush, cowboy! You know, they go off on these riffs against George Bush, you know, and I would be over in Great Britain or somewhere. But because he was pictured as not being part of the global community, and so Obama, he says, I'm a citizen of the global community when he went to Berlin, remember, before he was elected and everything. But so I said, America's going to become part of that global community. And what's been happening, you see, that's been happening. So we're moving toward this idea of globalism, and Christianity is being pushed out, which is the basis for European and American culture, is Christianity. And that's what made us first world, if you will, and was the Protestant heritage that we had in the Reformation. Okay. So all of that stuff is coming together, and so the rapture, and you have at the same time the world coming to Christ at a faster rate than they ever have, but not necessarily in America, you see. And that's what you've had is Paul was going east, and he had the Macedonian vision to come west. So Christianity has been circling the globe from Jerusalem, from east to west, westward. And Christianity comes along, and then it dies out, like in Europe or in the Middle East. And wherever Christianity has gone and dominated the culture, then once it declines, it's never been able to have a strong brand of Christianity after that, just stragglers here or there, you see. And so that's what's happening. And now it's hit China and the Far East, and I'm sure you know church, I think it was, I'm not saying it's biblical or anything, but that's an idea they came up with in the 1920s or something, that Chinese Christians will take the gospel back to Jerusalem, you know, completing the circle of it going around the world. And we seem to, there's no doubt we live in a time when the world in many ways has been evangelized. You follow? But there are even more people coming to Christ in South America, even in the Muslim countries and things like this where we haven't had strong Christianity before. And so the whole world, you know, is becoming evangelized. And so the world is ready for some kind of global judgment like it's never been before. And I would just say there's that sense and feel as well. But, so you have this events in the seven-year tribulation, the seal judgment, the trumpet judgment, the midpoint, the 144,000, the two witnesses are in the first half of the tribulation. I know John MacArthur disagrees, but I think he's wrong because the two witnesses are killed after 3.5 years, and if you have that occurring in conjunction with the second coming, it doesn't make any sense. I think it's got to be in the first half because the second half of the tribulation, there's probably going to be less evangelism because of the mark of the beast. And so the world is being evangelized like never before. Each age or dispensation seems to get more and more evangelism going on, you know, more, a higher ratio of believers and things like that. And so that's going to happen during the tribulation with all these judgments, dozens of specific judgments that are going to happen from God, from heaven, that he's going to supernaturally do. And I can't stand these Christians that try to figure out how there's going to be an eclipse and all this, and this could cause this event in the book of Revelation to happen or something like that. It's just crazy. God doesn't need that. He can just cause it to occur. And I don't think you can. And so they try to predict these natural alignments and stuff is when the tribulation is going to happen, all this stuff. It's just crazy. And, you know, then God accomplishes his plan of demonstrating in history what he wants to do, and you have the second coming. And then you have a 75-day interval of sheep-goat judgments and the reestablishment of the temple, the fourth temple that God brings from heaven according to Ezekiel. And it's mentioned in five other prophets, Isaiah, Zechariah, and others mention a temple during the millennium, and that is set up. It's a one-mile square from heaven by the Messiah at the second coming. And then you have the start of the millennium for 1,000 years. And then history ends with the burning up of this present heavens earth. I don't think it's a reconstruction, personally. It's a total destruction because the physical creation is polluted with sin in some way. And so it's contaminated. He has to start totally over. That's why you have to have a resurrection body that's not associated with sin. And that's why nature and creation, which is under man's domain, and heaven was polluted by the fall of Satan. So heavens and earth are totally destroyed, and brand new heavens and earth are created with streets of gold. And then we go on forever and ever and ever.
All right. That's a nutshell. There are a few details that I'd like to talk about. The 3.5 mark in the 7-year tribulation is extremely important.
Yes.
Because there's several details that must come to pass. As you mentioned, the two witnesses are killed at that point, and they are left without being buried for 3 days, and they're taken up. And 3.5 years, that's the point when the Antichrist will set up the image, the abomination of desolation. Mm-hmm. And then that's when the great tribulational judgment, the greater.
Yes,
right. Where God turns on the heat of the judgment, and that will happen at that half-year mark. And then also it says that Israel will be given wings and be taken into the wilderness and be hidden for 3.5 years.
Right.
And so that has to also be.
That's the last half.
That's the last 3.5. Mm-hmm. So that middle point is extremely important because there's a lot of prophecies that lead up to that 7-year, but that's when you know when you're in the middle of the 7-year tribulation, and that would be extremely important for the tribulational saints.
Yeah, Dr. John Whitcomb, who is co-author on the Genesis flood with Henry Morris, in his commentary on Daniel, speculates based on a passage in the book of Daniel that perhaps the two witnesses in the first half of the tribulation oversee the reestablishment of the Jewish Levitical system and the rebuilding of the temple, because they are given, because this Randy Price and I wrote a book back in 94 called Ready to Rebuild on efforts to rebuild the temple. I always say I'm ICE without the PR. And you get that? Okay. And Randy is a real expert on the temple. And, you know, that is a big deal. People can't figure out how are they going to rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount. It would cause World War III. And we don't know how it will happen. But I think Whitcomb has a good point that if you have the two witnesses that have supernatural power to call down fire from heaven if anybody messes with them, see, they're possibly protecting the Temple Mount area that Israel will have with their supernatural abilities, and the temple's rebuilt. That's why when they're killed and taken out of the way, that's why the Antichrist can then go in and set up his image in that rebuilt temple, because he's claiming to be God. Whereas they're prevented before that because of the two witnesses.
Do you believe these two witnesses are the two trees before the presence of the Lord in Zechariah?
Yeah, Zechariah 4. Okay. Yes, exactly.
All right. What is your speculation on their identity?
Moses and Elijah, but I don't know what that means. Well, what I mean is I don't know if they're going to be resurrected or just what form that means that they're going to be the two witnesses, you see, from the past.
Right.
But I can't figure that out. Or have heard any suggestions that make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, should we go to the third question?
Third question, all right.
We've got a few people that ask this question. Matthew chapter 6 has a lot of famous passages, well known. For example, Matthew 6:10, Jesus is giving instruction of prayer, and he says, "Pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Matthew 6:33 also very well-known passage, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Now, what is the proper application of these passages, given that it's in Matthew 6, it's before Matthew chapter 13, and how, as Christians, do we rightly apply these passages in our daily lives?
Yeah, well, I think the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 through 7, is Jesus's, we're in a political season, it's his campaign statement. In other words, he's presenting himself as Messiah, and he's teaching what is required to become a citizen of the kingdom. And so, it's his statement, and basically you get to the end, and he says, "Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will in no wise enter the kingdom of God." And these guys are going, "Those are the best guys we got. You know, how do you get in?" And then he uses the camel illustration. And Luke uses the term for surgical needle. Some people say, well, the eye of a needle is some small entrance into the wall of Jerusalem. No, that's not it. It's surgical needle. In other words, can a camel go through the eye of a surgical needle? No, it's impossible. That's his point. He's trying to tell them, present them an impossible standard that through the approach that the Pharisees were teaching was impossible. He's trying to get them lost because he knows that's why John the Baptist, JB, comes at the beginning and says, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Repent from what? From your thinking under the influence of Jews that you can keep the Mosaic law. See? And so you have him interacting with that. And so the Sermon on the Mount as a whole is his presentation of the impossible standard of what's required to become a citizen of the kingdom. And that's supposed to be preparing them for the grace of God, which comes along. That's my view and how all that would fit in. And so, it's no different than what the New Testament teaches, you know, about the fact that we need God. You know, Christ even says he came, he's a physician, he came for the sick. You know, you've got to think, understand that you're sick and all of these kinds of things. So he's offering himself as the candidate for Messiah, Messiahship. Right.
So in the disciples' prayer, pray then this way, your will be done, your kingdom come.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. So does that apply to the church? And if so, how?
Well, I believe that all of the moral stipulations are repeated in the epistles and are set within the context of the church age. But you can apply some of these, but you can also misapply. You know, this was the whole basis of the Bethlehem, you know, is they take the term peacemaker, and they have a master of arts in peacemaking. You see, there's all kinds of wrong assumptions. The wrong assumption is that you can come in and negotiate peace between people who aren't even believers. You see what I'm saying? What are you going to do, negotiate with the Hamas? Come on. You know, peacemaking, it's always the peaceful people who they try to say you're doing a bad job, you know, and you need to snuggle up to the guys that want to cut your throat, literally want to stab you if they're left alone with you and them, you know. And so, you know, that's the wrong context and wrong application today. I think it's simply showing God's standard of righteousness. The direct application comes from the ethical admonitions in the epistles. People have done studies to show that every ethical quality that's mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount is repeated within the church age context, you know, in the epistles.
Right. We have time for one more.
There were a lot of people that were asking. I think that one of the last images you showed was an artist's depiction of the lake of fire. Could you describe the lake of fire? Is it physical? Is it near? Is it far away? Where is it? What is it?
Well, I think it's a geographical location somewhere in the universe. And it's, you know, I don't know where. Planet Kolob or something? You know, I don't know.
Nearly, like, close to Krypton.
Yes, something
in
like
the 14th
that.
Galaxy. But.
Yeah. Well, I do think it's a physical location. That hell, see, hell is basically what the Bible calls Sheol in the Old Testament, Hades in the New. And hell is not the permanent place. That's where people are now, Luke 16, you see. And it also is a place of burning and things like this. And it's some geographical location somewhere, taking up space somewhere. But I don't think it, I mean, you've got people now with quantum physics saying it's a different dimension. You know, it's right here. But it's in the 10th dimension or something like that. You know, I mean, I don't buy personally quantum physics philosophy. And, you know, I don't think the Space Brothers are as near as these people say. But nevertheless, I think it's a geographic, just like heaven has got to be a geographical location somewhere in the universe. And I think it's going to be dark, and it's going to be brimstone and fire, literally. And I think that people are going to have a resurrection body to endure that for eternity. And I think that's what the Bible says. You know, I wish it were not so, but on the other hand, God does it. Reality. You have to, as a creature, adjust to reality.
Jesus said that the Gehenna is a place of where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. Do you believe that he's talking about literal fire there, or is it more metaphorical?
Well, yeah, I think he's saying that is continual death. The worm does not die, because when a normal body dies, the worm eats you up, and at some point you're gone. also the worm does not die means it's continual, never ending. But yeah, Gehenna was his place, and there's even among evangelicals a trend to say it refers literally to the place where they burn trash and bodies and all of that. Gehenna, not to hell. Yeah. There's a whole movement in evangelicalism today to deny that hell is going to be eternal. As we apostatize, you know, they become open more and more to these types of views. And so there's a pretty strong movement in evangelicalism saying that it's called annihilationism, that there is going to be a literal hell, but it will end after a period of time.
I think the Bible is clear that it is eternal. Jesus warned about this place. And you mentioned, it's a good illustration, you talked about city jail and state penitentiary. We talked about San Quentin, and that's where people go, a holding place until their arraignment and then their judgment, and after receiving the judgment, and they're sent to a more permanent place. And the lake of fire, talk about second death, it's a place of the unbelieving. Anyone's name not written in the Lamb's Book of Life is thrown there. The first two characters who go there are the false prophet and the beast. Satan doesn't even go there until after 1,000 years.
Right, he goes to the county jail.
He goes to county jail.
Because he's not finished in history.
Solitary confinement.
The abyss, yes, exactly.
For 1,000 years.
Then when he's finished in history, that's where you go. Lake of fire, the big house.
Yeah, you had a slide, you're about to go into that. He must be released for a short while.
Yes. And that's because he is a magnet, you know, attracts the unbelievers to him. Because you have... Just as you have Secret Service Christians today, the unbelievers are going to be the undergrounders during the millennium. They're going to be afraid to speak out and come out. But Satan somehow encourages them. There's something about him. You know, I think it's similar to a group dynamic. You know, they have all kinds of studies that people will, in a crowd, in a mob, will do things they wouldn't do as individuals. You know what I'm saying? And so there's some similar type dynamic that Satan provides that our sin nature responds to. And so, you know, he's going to attract all the unbelievers like a magnet. And so, and God's going to make quick work of them. They're going to be zapped with fire from heaven. He's not going to take 7 years to judge them this time. You know, and then he moves quickly into the great white throne judgment. They go in the lake of fire.
I have a question regarding the demons or the fallen angels. Now, they also serve under Satan. Are they going to be around?
Well, you know, Jesus said that the lake of fire was created for the devil and his angels. So I assume they're going to spend eternity in the lake of fire.
And are they going to be thrown in there before the millennium?
It's not clear. I think that the 200 million man army are not Chinese. Hal Lindsey came up with that. When I was in China in Beijing teaching the Book of Revelation, I showed them that. They thought it was really funny. It's demonic beings.
Is that in the same context of Abaddon? It's Lear.
Yes.
Okay, so it's definitely clear.
Yeah.
Women.
Well,
hair,
you have the fifth and sixth judgment are both demonic beings.
Right.
And so the fifth judgment is the
locust.
But then you have this army of 200 million men that come from the east.
Mm-hmm.
But they are clearly led by, they're clearly demonic beings, not human beings. And I think those are led out from the place where the fallen angels before the flood have been.
Mm.
And I think there's a parallel to Joel and all of this, Joel's army and everything.
Mm.
Yeah, there's all these connections there. But you have that being a demonic army, and it doesn't say what happens to them. It's just that the earth dwellers, you know, it's like today where they try to take somebody in. Let's say some young person has committed a crime or two, and what they do, they'll take them sometimes and put them in jail for a day or two to show you what it's like, and say, if you keep that up, young man, you're going to end up you're going to end up in Huntsville permanently, boy. You know, and so, or San Quentin. So, in a way, many of the judgments of the tribulation are God showing people the type of torment and things that they can expect if they will not repent. But they still don't repent. You see what I'm saying? That's why they want to hunker down in the rocks and the caves and take it. And it's demonstrating in history the power of an unbeliever, unaided by the grace of God. I mean, those people can be really dogmatic. And so they're getting exposed. That's why each judgment seems to get worse and worse. Actually getting demons. In other words, you want to have a little FaceTime with the demons that you're going to spend eternity with? Great. Here's two judgments right here. And then at the end of it, it says, and they would not repent of their worship of the demons. It says, and of these other things. Even after spending a little FaceTime with them and seeing what they're like.
All righty.
Please do stick around. Dr. Ice will be lingering around a little bit afterwards, and feel free to ask him any more questions you might have. Maybe we can end with this one then. Could you give us maybe the kind of top five books you'd recommend people to read, and maybe talk a little bit about the resources on your website?
Yeah, our website, pre-trib.org. You can just Google my name or something and find Pre-Trib Study Group. And we have on the front page a debate with Hank Hinnegraaff that Mark Hitchcock did on the date of the book of Revelation. And, of course, the significance of that is if you're a preterist, if you believe everything happened in the first century, then the book of Revelation had to have been written at the latest AD 65. And Mark Hitchcock, a friend of mine, wrote his doctorate in Dallas disproving that the book of Revelation was written in AD 95, and therefore preterism is impossible. And Hank Hinnegraaff, that whole 3-hour and 20-minute debate filmed by John Ankerberg, gave one argument for his view. And then I also have a debate that I did on September 25th with a pre-wrath person, if you want to watch that. You know, it's on there. And I've got three more debates lined up here in the next few months, and so we'll be putting those up for free if you're interested. And then we have probably about 1,000 articles on our website relating to eschatology. Probably by, you know, most of the people who have been influential in that area in the last 25 years have articles up there. They've been at our conference that we have in December every year. This will be our 25th year. And I have over 600 articles there on a lot of topics, different topics and things. And so you can read those articles, and we do have a Google search engine. You can search topics and everything like that. Let's see, is that what I was supposed to talk about?
Books.
Yeah, I would say a good overall book on eschatology is one by Mark Hitchcock called The End. Supposed to be a more simplified version of Pentecost Things to Come. That's a classic. Dwight L. Pentecost, who died at age 99.
These theologians live a long time.
Yeah. He taught till he was 98.
Wow.
I would recommend Arnold Frichtenbaum's Footprints of the Messiah. And also his book on Israelology is very good. And those are both like 800,000-page books.
I have it if you have insomnia. It's good reading.
I think our chart book is good to introduce you to an overview of things, you know, and stuff, even though there's views in there that I don't agree with. Like on the Olivet Discourse, I don't agree with the view in there, but I had to defer. I believe the entire Olivet Discourse, verses 4 through 31, refer to the tribulation, whereas some people 4 through 9 or 4 through 12 refer to the inter-advent age leading up to the tribulation. The tribulation starts in verse 12 or 9, you know, but I think it, the entire section refers to the tribulation. But nevertheless, I don't know. Let's see. I was trying to think of a book on the rapture. There are a lot of different books on the, you know, defending pre-tribulationalism. I don't know which one I'd recommend at this time. But
those are pretty good. So I heard a few books there. Definitely check out the book. And you can order one. Can they order one from Amazon?
Well, I tell you, I'll probably have a shipment of them come in.
You should wait.
A day or two, and I'll leave them. You know, if I have some left before I leave California, I'll be coming back to Oakland, and I can drop them off with David, and he can sell them.
I really like charts, and they really help you graphically see things and learn things, and so that's an excellent source. So that's clearly one. Fruchtenbaum's book.
Well,
two books.
I still think Ryrie's book called Dispensationalism best on the issue of dispensation. That's an excellent book. I went to his funeral. He died about 2 months ago. And he was a tremendously godly person and a tremendous theologian. And he was almost 91. Walberg was 94 when he died. So I call him the big three. They're gone now.
Definitely Charles Ryrie's book on dispensationalism.
Well, that was the original title, but he revised it twice more called Dispensationalism Mini Press.
Okay,
in light of so-called progressive dispensationalism, which he does not think is true dispensationalism.
That's a whole
other
internal debate, but that's a good one by Charles Ryrie. And then Things to Come by Dwight Pentecost, that's a classic one. So that's a heavy-duty reading, but it's good. It's very
Mark Hitchcock's book. The End.
The End.
It's a comprehensive book on eschatology.
That I don't have.
Yeah, it's only about 3 or 4 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. I think Tyndale's the publisher.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. I think we should wrap it up.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Ice. Let's give him a...